we're living in an economy, and we should be living in a society. And it just like it, boom, right? It hit me. And that frame is still here, like that we have actually, the society is now serving the economy. And, you know, one might argue that it should be the other way around.
Hello, and welcome to season one of the Design Economics Podcast, where we explore how design thinking driven by data is revolutionizing economics for the 21st century. My name is Vinny Tafuro, a futurist, economist, and your host for this episode. Today, I will be talking with my friend and colleague, Dr. Andy Hines from the University of Houston. Andy is an associate professor and the program director of the university's graduate program in Foresight. Our conversation today will focus on Andy's latest book, Imagining After Capitalism, the culmination of Andy's 10-year exploration as a futurist of what comes next. And with that, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Dr. Andy Hines.
Well, thanks so much for having me. What a great way to spend a morning.
Absolutely. Could you give a brief, a little bit of a background on future studies first and foresight as a field?
Absolutely.
Most people are not familiar with it.
Right. So I've actually been a professional futurist for about 35 years now. It's this, we like to say, we've been a stealth marketing our field for a long time, and we've succeeded there. We're still not relatively well known, but there has been a lot of, I guess you would say, professional work looking to the future. What does that mean for us here in the present? It's been going on in the private sector, military, and really what's interesting is the big growth in the last 5-10 years has been in the public sector and the government. And we're seeing that not only international, national, even now the local level. So there's been a nice kind of mini explosion of growth and interest in foresight in the last 5 or 10 years, which is awesome.
That is great. I find the field fascinating. You and I were introduced, I think it's going to be a decade now.
Wow.
by now a fellow futurist, because I was working on conscious capitalism and you were working on this idea of after capitalism. So can you maybe provide an overview of the book and maybe a path, since I know you've been working on it at least a decade, on what brought you to this and what it is?
Sure. And it's one of the great benefits. So I've been in the university space full time for about the last 10 years. And every spring we put together a conference, thematic typically. And in 2012, the discussion in the classroom, so to speak, was around what comes after capitalism. And it was Christopher Manfredi, now an alum, who was really had his bee in his bonnet about it. So we actually organized our spring gathering in 2012 around after capitalism. And we spent a whole day on it, and it was fun. We had a great time. And what the takeaway was, we had a lot more problem diagnosis. We didn't have a lot to say about what might actually come afterwards, right? So it kind of intrigued me, and I think so I started kind of following it loosely, and the more I started to follow it loosely, I got more interested in it, and over time that really picked up, and I think it was probably about 5 years later I'm like, ooh, there's something here. And I really dove in and kind of started the more formal research to what eventually became the book. And you could just plot the interest, right? Back in 2012, it was barely a blip, and you could just see it start to go. And if I had been a fast book writer, maybe I would have been first. But even in 2017, you go, oh, it's coming. And then sure enough, we've seen a real big, maybe not quite mainstream explosion of interest, but in the sector of the people like you and I that are thinking about this, definitely a big what comes next discussion has emerged.
Yeah, I would definitely say over that last 5-6 years, because I was a pioneer too with my first book on this and writing on this, and I'm like, nobody's talking about it as
right.
a system that is evolving and changing. So could you describe a little bit about the visions in the After Capitalism book?
Sure.
I think they're fascinating. So I love scenarios and I love visions.
Yeah, I mean, we can maybe do a little more on the how later, but the short story is it's a synthesis, right? So what I wanted to do is basically find what was out there and, using foresight methodology, but find what was out there and kind of tell the story of what's the current thinking about what could happen next, so to speak. So the the data, if you will, the research suggested these three clusters. And, so it didn't really come in with, I want three clusters, or I didn't know what I was going to find, right? So it just kind of came out that way. And the three are, the first one, the circular commons, is kind of the environmentally driven future, right? And I think those who are interested in that will find this a really appealing. The second, we call it the non-workers paradise, and someone else came up with that idea, which I thought was very clever, because of course the workers paradise was the Marx's original version, but we actually think it's a post-work future. And there, the driver there, social and political transformation, is kind of the main thing, right? And then in the third cluster was around technology, and end up calling that tech-led abundance. And of course there, technology is the big driver. And one of the things that comes up, I think anyone that's gone spend any time with these three visions or goes through the book, it's like, oh, wait, it's a little bit of each. And I agree, but I thought it was useful to actually kind of pull them as separate things, right? Because I think that's, what's how people tend to think, right? Like, I'm really interested in technology, and I'm going to be interested in that piece of the puzzle. But I think to really be successful, there's probably some sort of a synthesis of the synthesis, so to speak. It's a little bit of all of it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think, I guess that there's little bits of this going on now in all three of them. Do you think one of them has a dominance at this point in time?
Sure, yes. They're out, as we say, as futurists, right? The future's already here, right? And even in terms of the long term, like when we think of the long term, the seeds of the long term future are here now. They're just very faint. The signals are faint. And there's a lot of different signals, but if we look hard enough, we can see like some possibilities for that long term. So in the case of the after capitalism kind of framing, we can see some ideas about what that might look like right now. And I would say of the three, for sure, tech-led abundance is the most developed. I mean, we have like, we're even to the point where we have the best sellers, right? We have, Peter Diamandis talking about abundance, and Kurzweil's singularity, and you have Bostrom, super intelligence. So, those are somewhat developed visions of the future, obviously very techie-centric, but yeah, definitely the most mature of the three, no doubt.
Yeah, I would find, and looking at that tech-driven future, and I started this. I read Homo Deus by
Ah, yeah. That's another one
Harari,
that I included, by the way. Yes, very good, very
and
good.
it almost seems like the tech-led abundance has a foothold, because GDP doesn't have to change for that to be successful. Our kind of systems, whereas like, how do we get to a circular commons or a non-workers paradise? Whereas, like, it's almost like tech-led abundance is the baseline, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's to get to either one of those other two, if technology serves those purposes, we get there much faster. We get there much easier. I think we could get there without the technology driver, but boy, that would certainly make it a lot harder and probably make it take a longer time. So yeah, it could be the fundamental enabler, but not necessarily so.
So how did you, going back to the question of like, then how did these visions develop out of this? And we're both, you and I are both familiar with foresight, but our audience, how these things came together, they weren't, you're just not just a fiction writer.
Well, yeah, so our basic framework of we think of terms of three time horizons, and if thinking out to the third time horizon, what is the new system, the new future look like? So in this case, we have a capitalist system, neoliberal capitalist system today, and we're trying to say, if we look over the horizon, and that horizon, I put it at 20 to 30 years. I mean, you could argue that, but it basically want to say it's a ways off. But what does that new system look like? We call that the third horizon. We're in the first horizon, the current system. And then there's this zone of transition where the ideas, if you will, about what might come next compete, right, with one another. Or they might combine. They may, so there's that zone of transition where we'll see, again, it's like looking at how the different ideas might either play out, come together, and so on. So the first kind of I guess the framing idea is like we wanted to look beyond, what is the other side of that might it look like? And so in a sense, it's almost like picking a few potential winners, right? Something, some sort of environmental, right? Some sort of social political, some sort of tech. But we don't know exactly what that will look like. But the key thing that futurists can do is, try to paint that picture. So if when I say circular commons, you look at what, how that's described, does it create something in history? Oh, all right, yeah, I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I kind of, yeah, that appeals to me, right? Or, whichever one of those images it does appeal to you. It's just our goal is to try to create that a mental picture of what that future could look like, such that says, you know what, I'm going to do what I can, to drive towards that future. And so I think that the whole idea of the creating the images is to say, since we don't know what's next, we haven't really thought a lot about what's next, what might it look like, and what's appealing to me. So hopefully we're, and I know you, that's the same kind of work you're doing. Like we're putting ideas out there to kind of give people a chance to say, all right, let me look at this and what says to me, aha, this is something that I want to work to. So I think that's the goal, to put some images into the marketplace of ideas and see what resonates.
So how does the futures methodologies relate to design thinking? Because this is the I, before I got involved with the Foresight and Futures program, it was challenging for me to kind of link those two, and I've done a lot since then.
Yeah, so this particular work, it's a little bit different maybe than a typical client project in that where the bulk of the emphasis is just saying it's kind of answering the question, where might we want to go? And in a project work, we would then the second half of the project would be, all right, if that's where we might want to go, what do we do? And I think in this book, I did a pretty light treatment of that second part, like how do we get there? I mean, there's some indications, but in a sense, it was like I think first step, and I think that's true of any futures endeavor. First step is like, where do we want to go? Like, let's first find out, it's not in detail, but what's the directionality? What are the principles? Like, and then once we have some degree of agreement on that. Then let's go through and start mapping, if you will, we call it, road mapping, backcasting, however you want to call it. But what are the steps that you might take to get there? So, this is, if you will, this is almost like a part one. Here's the ideas, and we'll throw them out there in the marketplace, see if anything catches, and then if it does, or all right, well, now let's get to work on what the, if you will, the plan might look like.
That's excellent. That's excellent. The 20 to 30 year time frame for change, like where did that come from? And maybe you could describe the Horizons method a little bit too, in that.
Sure. So this it might be a little geeky, but I'll throw it out there anyway. We actually did some research because we our experience as futurists, my own, looking having done probably over 100 projects over the years, there seems to be a pattern and a timing of how the future unfolds. So we went back and looked at, we ended up finding 78 scenario sets, historical, like they started, they talked about the future, and we analyzed them and said, how do those How did the actual topic or domain, how did it actually evolve over time? Did it follow a pattern? What did that pattern look like? And in terms of the three horizons, like, when something started out in that horizon one, when did it go to two, and when did it get to three? So we basically had some historical data to say, yeah, you can follow that three horizons framework. And as we suspected, it takes a real long time to get to that third horizon. And I don't know if 30 years will end up being the average. I mean, I think it's, it could obviously, depending on the domain or the topic, it could really vary. However, that seemed to be, like a starting point. Like it takes, so in the case of, in this after capitalism, looking at it, I mean, what one of the judgments was, there's no doubt that the current system is under some degree of fire. Let's just put it that way. So there's some challenges. There's right. So we know that we're at least ripe that it's not going to be 100 years away, right? It's But it's still the dominant system. And again, we don't really have a clear set of alternatives out there, right? We really don't. So it's going to take some time to just even get the players into the game, so to speak. So that's why I said it. I thought 30 was, 20 was a little ambitious. 20 is, it collapses sooner than we think. 30 is probably a little bit more realistic. And one of the interesting points, though, Vinny, that came out of this research is I am actually one of the things that worries me the most is that, if you will, the current system collapses too fast, because we are just not ready. We are just not.
And
We
then we have
have,
a vacuum.
right? So that's, to me, is like, and it's interesting because one of the things you hear a lot in our space, I'm sure you've heard it, well, we need a collapse to kind of clear the space for something new. And I understand that idea, but boy, I think we'd be taking a bit of a risk here, because I just don't feel like we have enough. So, in a
Yeah,
sense, the
I see
gradual,
that.
right? The gradual approach is actually, I think, even if it were maybe we're impatient, it's actually probably a little bit more, a wiser course.
Yeah, I do see that. Now, I almost, you vacuum when people talk about like anarchy or something like that. That is the vacuum between systems. Anarchy is not a system. Something will replace it. And I almost wonder when you look at the, this is, kind of to one of our third tenet for the Institute is this idea of, economic literacy is a way of counteracting this kind of populist kind of uprising that goes, how do we talk about the economy in a better way? And I think what you reminded me of is we use in one of our presentations, the Kuhn cycle of scientific revolutions. And it is, if you look at when you and I first started talking about this over a decade ago, we were in that model drift period. Whereas today, and now over the last 5 years, we're in that crisis period. So how have you kind of taken on the idea of paradigm change, with your thinking on this?
Well, so a couple of maybe just a couple of points there that came up fairly in during the research. So one, in doing the 78 scenario sets, one of the things we saw is that by far the more common path of transformation was the we called it the looping pattern, but it was more gradual. Start, stop, start, stop, start, stop. We actually saw very few examples of collapse and replace. And we're left with the research question is, what happens after collapse? Because it isn't, if it's not going to transformation, like what exactly is happening? So again, that was, and that surprised us a little bit. Again, we would have guessed that, yeah, all right, we tear it down and then we rebuild. But it's like we tear it down and we don't necessarily rebuild. It goes away. And we're not exactly sure what happened. But so anyway, that was one observation. The data seems to suggest that gradual approach is actually the more common route to that, to the new system. And the other is maybe a little bit of a side interest, but I've read a lot and just kind of interested in revolutions, right? So in particular, I did a lot of reading around the Russian Revolution. And one of the things that striking things that comes up so many times, I guess, kind of a truism for the scholars, but you just see that a lot of times the revolutions succeed in the revolutionaries are a bit surprised, like, oh crap, we won. And like right on the other side of it, there's really no actual plan. Like it's either, are you spending all this time trying to win the fight, and then when you win, it's like, oh God, what do we do now, right? And
It's
so
the dog that caught the car.
exactly. And so that seems to be a pretty common pattern. I thought, ooh, that's the kind of thing that scares you a little bit. It's like, wow, yeah, if we do topple it, do we have anything behind it?
Yeah. What's your, a little bit deeper on that, what's, and this kind of goes into a little bit of that creativity part of it, in foresight and futures, I think there's an inherent creativity and we acknowledge paradigm change. Have you had much discussion yet? I know the book's not out yet, officially, with economists on how this impacts or where they're at with it.
Not really. I mean, I would say so. The one sort of bias in terms of the works that I did. So I should probably just mention quickly. So there's really the major research path. There were really two major research paths. So one was, I guess you'd say, classic horizon scanning, where we look for signals of change. So we create a kind of a map of the, in this case, the capitalist system. And really, the way that I've defined it, and I think most would agree, it's not just the economic system, it's really like the operating system of the world, right? I mean, it's so central to the way we live. It's kind of more like an operating system, right? Nonetheless, I did decide, so path one, horizon scan, look for signals of change relating to that basic system. And then the second path was to look at, who actually has talked about, at least either in part or in full or even in tidbits, a new economic system. So there is a little bit of a bias. I tried to keep the search around, next economic, next, as opposed to looking at every single new idea, right? Because I mean that I think I would have drowned. And even so, there I would say that definition was a bit permeable. I mean, some of like the tech-led abundance was really not super duper economic, right? But I tried to keep, and that was the original focus, was like, what's the next economic system? So there is a So in a sense, I came across a lot of economic works. You probably won't be surprised to find that not a lot of the actual long-term visions were by economists. Shocking news, I know.
It is shocking. It's not shocking, and it's
I know.
unfortunate because I think that is, something lacking in the field of economics is a lack of historical context and a lack of long-term vision. And so what you end up is you don't have it's just not being a creative field because it's what I see today and I can apply math to.
Well, it was good. I mean, the economist, if you will, the most help I got from that was the explanation of the current system, right? And the history and how we got here, and maybe some of the problem diagnosis. But yeah, not a lot of Horizon 3 thinking coming in that from that space. But definitely useful, right? I mean, I learned a lot from how they talked about it. But
What I'm interested in next is kind of, you look at how this brings visions of the future and talking about our economic system to the forefront. I know you had said at one point, about how we're living in the economy. And so, as we cultivate this literacy towards people understanding economic ideas and visions, what is the importance of stuff like this, and how does making this accessible work for?
I heard this. I heard Robert Reich, and I can't remember when it was, 15 years ago. And he, I don't, I still cannot find the original source for it. It's driving me crazy. And I think he was actually pulling from Karl Polanyi's work, which I read, which was fabulous. And it was basically, he had said this, made this quip, and it might have been like on an NPR interview or something, right? That we're living in an economy, and we should be living in a society. And it just like it, boom, right? It hit me. And that frame is still here, like that we have actually, the society is now serving the economy. And one might argue that it should be the other way around, right? The economy should be serving the society. And I think the pervasiveness of that is just, it's one of those things, like it's the fish in the water, like the fish doesn't know it's in the water. Like it's just so, like, and if you think about where we are today, like almost every single thing we do has turned into some kind of an economic transaction. We've economized everything, sex, parenthood. I mean, everything is and it's so ubiquitous that it's almost hard to kind of step outside it and say, wait a second, like, is this what we want? Right? Like we don't even challenge it anymore for the most part. So I think that's a, boy, that's a tough one, right? Like, how do you help people get out of that? Get kind of like stand above it and say, is this, this is the, these are the choices we made. Do we want to make different choices? And I think the answer is yes, but it's like, just be able to get that question across is I think quite challenging.
How do you it, that visioning side, and this is maybe a little bit of how does the intersection between kind of sci-fi or maybe not sci-fi as much as like a solar punk future visions compared to like the visions you're proposing?
Sure. There's actually two visions that came from, I'd say, the sci-fi-ish literature that I just thought were fabulous. And they've really informed my thinking. Not the specifics necessarily, but the principles. So one is Carl Schroeder, who's a graduate of the OCAD Futures Program up in Canada. He's a sci-fi author that became a futurist. I don't know, he's both. Anyway, he had this idea. Basically, he described a scenario unfolding in which the kind of the gaming community, developed its own little economy, right? And over time, expanded that gaming economy such that it starts to rival, quote, the real economy. And then, of course, in the story, there's that sort of battle, right? But it was just like, I'm not sure the whole thing, but like there was some really like, does a new system grow up alongside the existing? Interesting. And the other one was Cory Doctorow's Walk Away. And his basic idea there is that, the alternative, if you will, just people just check out, right? So it's the off the grid, off the grid gone wild, so to speak, right? But people just started checking out of the existing system and, if you will, kind of forming their own. Obviously it starts off small and then it starts to scale up over time. But this kind of check out idea. And I think both of those principles are, very interesting and plausible, and maybe it's a little bit of both, but super duper helpful, helpful works. I mentioned them quite prominently because I thought they were perfect.
That system within a system,
Right?
and it kind of evolves as it goes. And I know this was, I forget his name. Neil Herbert wrote a book on economics back in the 30s or 40s, maybe. But or no, it was a recap. I think it was in the 50s at that point. But it was, basically compared the economy and society as like a chrysalis, and like, it's not one motion that changes. It's all these little motions that break apart the shell, and out emerges the butterfly or the new system that's always been there inside in some capacity.
Right. And that gets back to what we've learned as futurists in this kind of journey, if you will, this kind of journey across the three horizons. It's not like, on September 17th, 2045, we're going to declare the post-capitalist society, right? It's just going to be one of those things where it's going to, maybe in retrospect, we might put a date on it. But as we're living through it, it will be, new systems don't just suddenly replace the old ones. There's this kind of, tension over time and dynamic interplay, and it's at some point we see the the prevalence of the new system start to overtake the old. So
Yeah.
there's it's, it's it, we'd like to just say we're gonna just replace it like it tomorrow, but it doesn't work like that.
Do you see o over the coming years ideas like this kind of working more closely with economics or with other fields? I know, future, from our standpoint, economic literacy is important. And I know from the University of Houston, futures literacy is important. That, it's not just reading, writing, and arithmetic anymore. Like, we need to have literacy in so many different ways, but how those might intermingle and evolve.
Well, I certainly hope so. I guess, I mean, it's just so, I guess that, like, I would go back to that. To me, where I would hope we could start is just in that sort of paradigm question, like just starting to say, wait a second, like, again, kind of framing that, like, what do we want to do, so to speak, right? I mean, what is the ultimate goal? Because you could argue, especially with tech-led abundance, like the bad version of tech-led abundance, if you will, is we do create the abundance, but it's still, three people get all the money and everybody else is, fighting for scraps, right? Like, so I think you can kind of imagine how the wealth thing could really. But then, how do we address that question of what do we want to do with that? How do we want to distribute it? How do we want to use it? Obviously, those are the huge questions, right? And I guess, to your point, like, have just thinking that through. I mean, that's even in the research that I did to come up with these visions. I mean, there's some folks who had kind of went down to some levels of detail, right? Well, here's how you'd organize a, participatory direct democracy, but it's usually at like a really small scale, right? Like, here's how you could do a village, right? So there's some fragments of ideas of how you could, how you could redistribute, but boy, I mean, we're not even at the point of asking the question yet. And I think first we're gonna ask the question of what we want. So maybe to summarize that a little bit better, what I did see is a lot of the proposals, so to speak, around what that would look like is it's very much a kind of a local, decentralized, direct democratic, and some might say there's a lot of wishful thinking in there, but that seems to be the model that is kind of out there, right? And seems to be emerging, but not a lot of detail on how we pull it off, but some ideas about the scale is local, distributed, and networked.
Gotcha. What, so to that, we've been kind of talking as optimistic futurists on how this is going to happen. Who's resisting this, and how does that play in?
Yeah, and again, this is just to kind of reinforce our futurist thinking here. One of the things we know why, and it came up when we did the research about, wow, those, if you will, the we talked about that horizon one. There's a dominant system with dominant players. And usually the dominant system and the dominant players want to keep things the way they are because it's to their benefit. I mean, it's just, basic self-interest, so to speak, right? And so we know that usually that sort of current system hangs on longer than we might think because the people who support it are in the power positions. Right? It just makes sense, right? So it is difficult to kind of and what we tend to see is what that system does as it starts to recognize the attacks are, if you will, are becoming a little more direct and a little more effective. What compromises do we make? Like, how can we accommodate some of these new ideas and bring them into our, and kind of keep control of it within our overall framework? So it tends to try to co-opt some of the new ideas to keep them, to keep them in their proper place. So and I joke, like, I know it's not a real thing, but the current system is very clever at preserving itself. It's
It
not an
is.
entity, but it's almost, it thinks that way, right? It looks that way. Like, he's like, oh, we're, ooh, boy, that's a, we got to get that one. We got to go grab that or else that could really harm us, right? And so, that, in general, that tendency is to self-preservation is, it's a tough one to get past.
It is, and that's something I think back to my naivety in the beginning on all of this when I was like, really thought I was like,
Right.
well, if you tell people the system can be changed, they'll want to change it.
Right.
And it's realizing now, how few people really see that, which I think that going to, what do you feel the role is for, additional work like this? And fiction as well to kind of paint, we have a lot of dystopia out there,
Yes.
far less of this.
The good news is, even though I've kind of laid out the basic, I mean, I would say that's a basic assumption. Your current system tends to preserve itself. However, there is underneath that, there is, and why it eventually does change, there is a growing groundswell that says, hey, this isn't right. We need something different, right? So that's always happening. Now, what I think, and why I think we can pull this off in 20, 30 years is there is a groundswell of people that just saying, like, look, this current system, this current capitalist system is based on some assumptions about, growth and competition and so on that actually made great sense for centuries. This is not like it's a new system, right? It has worked very well for a long time. And we're moving into a future context where that kind of behavior is actually not a good fit with the what we need in the future. Right now, we obviously have to deal with things with, climate, resource scarcity. There's a whole host of issues where there's probably a different, we need a different mindset. And when I've, one of my other research interests in the long-term future of values is you've seen those kind of new value, we'll just call it for the sake of argument, the newer values are actually growing, right? And poised, I think, eventually to become the next dominant paradigm. So even though right now it might look like, oh my goodness, there actually is a lot where, and it's basically saying we're going to ask questions like, why are we? Why have we made this choice? And maybe we should make a different choice. So I do see in the long term that there is some very, very positive potential for challenging that paradigm. But it won't happen at the same time. It won't happen automatically. To your point, what can we do? We can encourage that, right? We can grow that, we can nurture that and help support that sort of alternative thinking.
I like that. I like that a lot. And I think, maybe we'll start wrapping up a little bit on this. So you seem optimistic about this.
Yes.
And what is the next step for the book? These visions are coming out. What is the kind of, what's that, the rollout of after capitalism for you?
Well, thanks. So, yeah, doing the we'll see. Doing a lot of these kind of talking about the book, workshopping it. Just throwing the ideas out there and basically seeing what sticks. Right? What if anything sticks? I would say that no matter what happens, I'm now in the game here, and as a as one of the things that futurists do is we always are scanning for signals of change, right? What's and this is just in my in the fiber of me now. I can't help but every time I look out, I see signals, right? And it's one
Curse.
example, right? So I'm going to keep tracking it. And one of the things that I'm getting close to the old in next career is like. And done a little bit of this already, just don't have the luxury of time to do it on a large scale. Let's go visit. Like we say, all right, so you say the pockets of the future are already here. Well, go see them. What are they doing? And like go meet those people, go talk to them. What are and kind of reporting, almost doing like a travel log on the future of after capitalism. So that's one of the that's kind of my one of my grand hopes. And just kind of bringing hope hoping helping bring to light, like we're saying, like these there are good signs. There are positive signs, and just kind of maybe cover that in a different way, in a more instead of a book format, actually going out into the field and kind of sharing some of that stuff. So I look forward to continuing. I ain't done.
Good, good. So how will listeners find you when they stumble on this podcast? It'll come out, podcast will come out before the end of January. I think your book, give us a little bit about the release of your book, how to
Sure.
reach you, etc.
I think well, thanks for that. So yeah, the physical book is already out in Europe. So if you're listening from Europe, you can get it from the publisher right now. And actually, if you're in the US, you can order it from Europe, but it will cost you quite a bit more than the book itself to get it shipped from Europe to the US. So it's the European publishers in Europe. So it's a European release first. It'll be out in the US February 10th. You can also get the ebook right away from the publisher in Europe, Triarchy Press. And I love Tri they're just such a wonderful, I want to shout them out because they're one of those like they have a vision, they're systems thinkers, they're really committed to getting good ideas out there. And I just love the ethos of it. They've been wonderful to work with, really competent, and they put out some good stuff. It's one of those things where you want the next Grisham, right? If you want to make money as a publisher, right? Publishing systems book is not the way to, get rich and famous. And that's not what they're doing, right? They have a mission and they're supporting that and bless them, right? I really liked working with them. So that's basically the story. It'll be out in full by February 10th.
Excellent. And so how would people reach you directly if you are up for that
Sure,
conversation?
absolutely. So if you just type in Andy Hines, I have a book website called imaginingaftercapitalism.com, all one word. I have a my blog or website is called Hindsight, all one word, Hindsight. Haha, very clever. And if you just type in Andy Hines or ahines@uh.edu, so I am open to being contacted. It is interesting, Vinny, one of the things I noticed, so I synthesized a lot of work of other folks, right? And I offered them the book, just say, hey, I mentioned your work and would you like to look? And I notice a lot more people these days are saying, I am no longer taking any unsolicited emails. I don't know if you've run into that, but because some, you can get so slammed with requests and stuff that some folks are saying, like, I just can't deal with the volume anymore. So I
Yeah,
hope.
I've definitely seen that same thing.
Right? But
Yeah.
I want that problem, sort of. I don't know, right? But right now I
Be
don't
careful
have
what
it.
we
So,
ask for, right?
right. So right now I'm like, come on, let's go, let's discuss, let's do it. So share and let's make some things happen.
Well, thank you, Andy, so much. Andy Hines is the author of Imagining After Capitalism. And I am so grateful to have had you here on the Design Economics podcast. And, thanks again.
Thank you for having me. What a blast. That boy, that went fast.
It did. See you next time.
All righty.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Design Economics Podcast. We will be back next month with another engaging conversation. You can find the Design Economics Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Please check out our show notes on our website, designeconomics.io. The Design Economics Podcast is produced by the Institute for Economic Evolution, and I am your host, Vinny Tafiro. Thank you for listening.